Hello, dear people, and welcome to Out to Lunch, where I take someone utterly brilliant for a slap-up meal, we chat, and naturally we record the proceedings for your enjoyment, although, to be fair, we have a lovely time too. My guest today holds a fairly unique place in popular culture. He hosts mainstream TV shows, the sort that get very big viewing figures, yet his background is in hard-hitting, often political stand-up comedy. He's also presented a number of documentaries on some very challenging subjects close to his heart, and he's had the ear of a few very influential politicians. He's presented Fame Academy, Love Island, Sport Relief and The Breakfast Show on BBC Radio 2, and on the other side of the coin, my dad, the peace deal and me, coinciding with the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement and 100 years of union, exploring how events of the past are shaping the future of Northern Ireland. Today, complete with what I believe we call explicit language, do listen later if you're in the car with the kids, we talk about flying from Ireland to LA just for brunch, it was worth it, having dinners in pyjamas with Mo Molan, and how Des O'Connor disowned him. It's comedian and TV personality, Patrick Keelty.
The security guy goes, "Which one of you guys owns this bag?" And it's my bag. There's a handgun in the middle of the bag. And they turn to Des O'Connor and go, "Do you know... I've only just met, Pat, I'm not right." So from being like the showbiz pally, Des is going, "I don't know who this Irish fucker is."
So for this episode, I've come to Gray's Inn Road in London, just down the road from the ITN headquarters, to a restaurant called Otto's, opened by a great man called Otto Tapassi. And really, it's a temple to French classicism. It does the sort of dishes almost nobody does anymore. It's even got a duck press. Look that dish up. But anyway, Paddy Keelty knows his wines, he likes his food, and I didn't want to waste this on someone who was merely interested in a lettuce leaf, because I can guarantee we are going to be fed today and fed properly, and there will be wine involved. It could get messy. Let's go in. Paddy!
This place is...
magnificent. It is magnificent. Lovely to see you, dear love. You've met Otto, whose name is above the door.
Yes.
And will lead us through.
Good afternoon, Patrick.
Thank you, Otto.
Can I have a drink? Would you like a drink?
What are you having, Jay?
What about that, something?
Lovely.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Let's do that. We're doing that. You've talked about growing up in Dundrum as a beautiful, idyllic childhood.
Hmm.
And comedy, being there as a backbeat, sitting in the car with your dad, listening to filthy tapes.
Billy Connolly.
Billy Connolly.
Yeah. Oh, for fuck's sake!
Could you do that? Because we're not going to get him now. We know that.
It's that thing, isn't it? Where I remember listening to Billy Connolly, and he goes, "There's something magical about fuck off. There's no ambiguity to it. Fuck off sets its own context. It's why you never read fuck off," he hinted. It's just like from one of his great... And then those are the tapes that you'd have been listening to when you were sort of like, you know, 13 and 14 with your dad. And the idea, you know, of a man in his early 40s and you 14 sitting there listening to the same thing.
That's a kind of champagne for you, there we go.
Well, what should we have? The souffle au fromage looks good. We've got a bit of T-bone action there, don't we?
We do.
What are you going to have?
So I think I am going to have the scallops to start.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to get steak tartare, particularly because they do a lot of table side stuff.
The wife loves a steak tartare.
Does
she'd
she?
Be very jealous.
And it looks like we're doing smoked salmon before, a little bit, just
yeah.
A taster.
That's an appetizer.
Okay. Start. Your good health, Jay.
And to you.
There you go. It's champagne before 1 o'clock. There's very little wrong with that.
The thing I find amazing, looking at your story, is your father is killed when you're just before your 17th birthday.
Yep.
You set up one of, if not the first, comedy club in Belfast. How old were you?
21.
It's very little time between those two things. Although it's an ocean of time in a young person's life.
I had been doing some little bits of comedy from when I was about 15.
It's not that. It's that your material, very early on, was taking on the Troubles at a time when, to describe it as a live subject,
well,
was very, you know, it very much was.
Context is everything. You're asked to host a comedy club every week. Belfast, smaller place, regular audience, can't do the same stick. So I'm writing topical stuff from the news. The news was the Troubles. The stuff that that audience wanted to hear was what they were living. So you didn't think you were doing anything extraordinary. I remember when CNN turned up outside the club and they did that classic, you know, while Belfast burns, young people laugh. Today, downtown, Tuesday, Patrick Healy, whose own father was murdered in the Troubles, is the host of the Empire Laughs Back Comedy Club. And wow, do they like this material. And you're going, okay. And I kicked back from that. I'm going, this is a fucking cliche. And they were trying to sort of portray you as some type of comedy Batman, you know, which was, his own father was murdered, and so he went into this comedy cave and came out and put this cape on and then did jokes to the paramilitaries and, ooh, that'll show you for killing my dad. But it wasn't like that. I was like a comedy comper, which was doing
material. You needed material.
I needed material. However, there was one point where a guy came up to me and said, you know, well, we like that joke, but we're not sure about that. The, you know, the boys aren't sure about that joke.
So are we talking IRA?
Yeah, we're talking like paramilitaries. They're like, you know, going, we're not sure about that one.
Is that the worst review you've ever had?
I mean, was probably not. Absolutely not.
Which wing of the provisional IRA are you? Well, I'm mostly comedy reviewing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, we had that thing where there was all those splinter groups where, you know, it was... It was kind of the real IRA, the surreal IRA, you know, I can't believe it's not the IRA. Yeah. Like, there's all these sort of things.
What was your response to this? When they're basically, they're trying to scare you off doing certain
gags. Yeah, and I just said, look, I'm a very average comedian here. I said, but if you want to turn me into some type of fucking hero, have a go. I said, I genuinely don't think popping a comedian is kind of great press. Right?
At which point, how's smoked salmon?
Amazing.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Amazing. So there are this is not my thing.
Normally
not. This is excellent.
So you've just ordered a goat's cheese souffle, a veal T-bone.
Yes.
And then we'll get to dessert. How did you take to vegan life in LA, Paddy Keelty?
So there was there's a restaurant on Melrose called, I think it's called Crossroads.
Mm-hmm. Melrose Avenue being a very hip.
Very, very, very cool. Hipster place. And this is a place where they were doing the vegan thing, trying to make it be like meat. It kind of worked for a hot second. Kat had been over there. The wife had been over there for a while.
So it should be said, your wife, Kat Dealey,
yes,
had gone off to the States to be incredibly famous on primetime television.
Yes.
You went there too.
And I went there too and wasn't. you'd go for a meal and I'd say, I can't believe they remember the special. So they do this thing when they come out in Los Angeles. They go, hi, I'm Brad. I'm going to be looking after you tonight. And what they do is they do this team talk thing where they say, okay, guys, we got some really, really great stuff happening here tonight. I'm going to give you four things. I'm going to keep eye contact while I'm telling you all of these things. And I'm going to say two things, which I think you probably should have. Then I'm going to go something which probably isn't selling very well on the menu. And then I'm going to say that that's the thing that I really prefer, personally my favorite. And they do all this thing. And I would say, how in the name of bejesus are they remembering all of these things without reading?
I assume that basically they're all actors and they're all out of business and they're all, every single person at any table could be an audition.
Right, but it's that thing of that you suddenly realise that the only lines that they have to remember that day, because they haven't landed the part in Succession or Game of Thrones, is essentially what it is.
It's not overstating to say that you went to LA for love and Kat's career and all of that.
Yeah. We worked together on a show called Fame Academy years ago. That was the BBC's attempt at pop stars or pop rivals or whatever those things were called. As you know, there's a very old rule, never get your honey where you get your money.
Not to start a relationship with your co-workers on primetime television.
Yes, that's another way of putting it. So then it would have been her birthday. She was in LA. I was in a small pub called the Mahara Inn, which is about 300 yards from my house in Ireland. With an 8-hour time difference, I decided to text her, happy birthday. She texted me back. I rang her. She said, oh, it's a shame you're not around. She said, I'm having a birthday lunch tomorrow in the Beverly Hills Hotel. I said, I'll be there. And she said, go to sleep, Keelty, you're pissed.
You're in Belfast at this point.
I'm in Dundrum, County Down.
Your hometown.
Home village, an hour south of Belfast at 2 o'clock in the morning.
And you've got to make it. This is impossible.
What I did, got home, booked the 7 o'clock flight the next morning, which was that day. Got on a taxi at 5, got to the Georgie Best Airport at 6, got on the 7 o'clock flight, which gets into Heathrow Terminal 5 at 8:35. Normally gets in 10 past 8, was a Sunday, that worked out okay. First flight to LA with BA is always the 9:50. That goes in the C gates, the Belfast flight gets in on the A gate. No bags to check in, hand luggage only. The 10 past 9 flight, with the 8-hour time difference, gets you into LA at 1:15. Hand luggage only, first off the plane, first to passport control. You're through there at about 1:25. Taxi on the street, get to the Beverly Hills Hotel at 2 o'clock. Our lunch had started at 1 o'clock. Pulling up outside the Beverly Hills Hotel, I'm telling the taxi driver the story. And his words to me are, that's a pretty good story. Would you like me to wait? I walk into the Polo Lounge. She's having the McCarthy salad. I say, I'll have a gin and tonic. She falls off the chair and we've been together ever since.
Which probably explains what a McCarthy salad is. Named after a polo player called Neil McCarthy. Now, in London,
yes,
it turned up. I mean, it looks hyper-organised. Like someone with an organising compulsion has been at the salad bar at Garfunkel's, which is what I wrote in my review. And there are separate little pillows of beetroot and egg white and egg yolk and cucumber and tomato, and then in the middle an avocado that's been halfway through one of those egg slices, and so it's fanned.
Yeah.
And then on the side there was an overly emulsified balsamic dressing which looked a little bit like gravy, and they presented this to us with much sort of performance, and then they mixed it, and it really looked like someone had had a bit of a problem. How does it look at the Polo Lounge in Beverly Hills? Is it that much better?
I find the best place to eat the McCarthy salad is whenever you're actually in a booth beside Leonardo DiCaprio, who doesn't know that you've actually heard him discuss the Oscar-winning speech that he thinks he's going to be making for Wolf of Wall Street. Because he'd actually won, I think it was the Golden Globe.
So he'd won the Golden Globe and he assumed the Oscar was coming down the chute, and he discussed his speech.
He was discussing, you know, what he may or may not, yeah.
Oh, things have turned up. Do you know what? I'm going to hold for a moment.
Yeah.
Which one is this, Otto?
So here we have a lobster souffle.
And mine is a scallop. So you've got a goat's cheese souffle.
I have a goat cheese souffle, but...
And there's a lobster souffle, and then this is a scallop which has been baked in with pastry, and Reuben here, who is helping
Holy
Otto.
Holy Mary, mother of moly.
Here you have lobster.
Yeah.
That's a lobster sauce. And the lobster souffle, obviously. And then that lobster sauce also goes on the scallops.
Well, I'm very efficient here.
I'm going to do you some merceau with this.
Oh, wow.
Patrick, you like taste it? That's
completely... Yeah.
Are you okay with the merceau?
Which is a nice, clean, elegant merceau.
What's Kat doing today?
A bit more than she thinks. A bit more than previously thought once the merceau turns up.
You've made a new documentary for the BBC.
I have.
On Northern Ireland, 100 years. Mm-hmm. The full title is...
Patrick Keighley, 100 Years of Union.
I watched it on iPlayer.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating documentary because it's you... Very emotionally, I may say, looking at the what's going on right now, partition on the island of Ireland. Now, in 2018, you wrote an absolutely brilliant Twitter thread. If anybody wants to find it, Google your name, Patrick Keelty, Twitter thread, and they will find it immediately, which laid out what the implications of Brexit were for Ireland, for Northern Ireland, and so forth. You're nodding at me. And it was brutal, and it was to the point, and made it clear that nobody had really thought this through. The documentary, were you constrained? Because there's very little in there echoing what you'd said in that Twitter thread about the failure of current government policy to think through the impacts of Brexit on Northern Ireland.
Whenever I wrote that thread, that was, whatever you do here,
you're screwed.
We're kind of screwed. You can still stand back in 2016 going, can't you see Brexit's not a good idea? Or you can actually go, we're 5 years down the road. How are these kids feeling and what can we do for them now? Because Brexit's not been reversed anytime soon. So the film for me was to go in there and say, how can we survive this? Rather than say what you've done on us to try to make us survive is shit.
Your restraint is amazing. This is really patronizing. You're an extremely good journalist. I don't know if you ever intended to be a journalist, but you are.
Okay.
And your ability to stop, to let people speak and all of that, and your restraint. For background, and we will get there, and it's obviously a major part of your story, is that when you were 16, your father was murdered by loyalist terrorists. So to say you have skin in the game is something of an understatement. But you at one point go to the bonfire for marching season. Actually, you help build the bonfire and you applaud it as it goes up.
Yeah.
Your empathy is amazing.
If you look at the Northern Ireland story, you either have to have a Northern Ireland that functions for a minority of people, which is the Catholic population.
Yeah.
Or if you happen to constitutionally change the future of the place and it becomes a United Ireland, then the minority is going to be those unionists. If you don't attempt to actually try to understand how somebody else feels, That's kind of what it's all about, because 5 years goes like a flash.
Yeah.
2016 Brexit, 2021, we're still here. 10 years, 15 years is a generation. How do you live the transition years? I wanted to go there to actually see what the good and the energy and the good things were in it. I see it as selfish.
You see it as selfish to...
I see it as selfish for me to go and try to understand something that's actually going to make me think in a different way.
You seemed a lot more emotional, if I'm honest, in this one than you did in the previous documentary, which
100%.
Which was curious, because the previous documentary was my dad, the troubles, and me.
Yep.
Revisiting the fact of your dad apparently being an innocent bystander who got murdered for no reason. Subsequently, you seem to have uncovered a reason, which was that he was trying to object to a protection racket run by the loyalists. But actually, in that one, you're quite not chilly, but you're very straight up about everything. But in this one, you really did seem despair. At one point, you actually do cry on camera.
The tears in the second film are the despair that people who actually need a little bit of help, rather than been given that help, have actually been asked to solve the puzzle that they've already solved, that they knew was impossible. And they've been handed a different puzzle, rather than been paraded round the town going, fuck, you solved that puzzle. Oh my God. I was like, yeah, anyway, here's another one that we know you can't solve. So those were tears of despair.
I've just pushed the lobster souffle across to you because...
It wasn't pushed away, was it?
No, it wasn't pushed away. It was taken unto... I'm interested particularly in one element that happens around the peace process, which was you became friends with Mo Molum.
Yes.
Who was the Northern Ireland secretary. Because what people I think, don't necessarily understand is you have the Good Friday Agreement in 98. It takes until 2007 to actually get a power-sharing agreement.
This is my point. Things take a long time. How do you live your life during that time? What do you do during that time? That fascinates me.
She was an extraordinary figure, Mo Molem. And if you're listening to this, you know you're not aware of her looker-up. Very charismatic. Mm. Did she not used to have extraordinary weekend house parties at her official residence?
Yeah.
Who would turn up at those house parties?
New Labour was very good at the showbiz thing.
Wasn't Graham one of them? Didn't Graham Norton go?
Graham, you know, Paul O'Grady, there'd have been a lot of, you know, a lot of showbiz people. You know, what was interesting about it was that was the Queen's official residence in Northern Ireland. As a Catholic growing up in Northern Ireland, so I remember the first time she invited me, and she went, "Pat, you must come for supper." And I said, "Okay." I said, "So what should I wear?" She went, "Well, Pat, I'm wearing some British Airways pajamas, and I'm not fucking changing. So make your own mind up." And I'm thinking, she's probably joking. So, I mean, I put a shirt on, you know, a pair of trousers, lose the jeans, don't wear a jacket, you know, that kind of thing, or I'm going to go sort of catch.
What time is supper in this instance?
Come at 7 for drinks, dinner for 8. Right.
Right.
And sure enough, you get through three lines of security and, you know, the RUC waves you through and, you know, you go through with the guns and all the rest. And there she is. She just comes out onto the gravel wearing the navy blue BA
first class pajamas,
four sizes too big, right? A pair of furry slippers. And I said, "You weren't joking." She went, "I wasn't fucking joking. You don't know the day I've had." and I remember
I've had Martin McGuinness and Arnie and Ian Paisley bang away at each other.
So you'd sometimes come for a dinner, it would look like this. And then she'd say, "Sometimes come for dinner." And so you were in the private quarters where she was, and it was just a little table. And it was you know, her and John. And I said, "Look," I said, "my dad's brother was a Green Beret, two tours of Vietnam, five Purple Hearts, was a spy in Berlin. His wife worked in the Pentagon. She was in the Pentagon at 9/11, and her day was away on an away day, and that's where that was meant to go. So, American military family. He was over visiting, and I said, "Well, my uncle Eugene's over." I said, I can't come tonight." She went, "Fucking bring him." So suddenly you've got this American turning up. My uncle Eugene, 6'4". He then turns up with full American military deference to. "This is the Secretary of State, this is the British House of, and there's the Queen. And there's a visitor's book." And Mo says to him, "Don't sign that page, sign this one, this will be fun." And so the Queen had signed on one of her official visits. She went, "Just sign there, that'll give them something to fucking sort out later on." Right? They'll go, "Who's this Eugene? Who's this Eugene below Elizabeth?" So, you know, great. But we could not have done what we did there without her, because people talk about the dead cat strategy.
Throw a dead cat on the table to distract from everything else.
Well, Mo just, first meeting, threw the wig on the table when she was meeting Sinn Féin.
Because she was undergoing chemotherapy.
She was undergoing chemotherapy. And people didn't know what to do. She disarmed people, metaphorically and literally. We couldn't have done that without her.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I watched your first Live at the Apollo.
Yeah.
2007. Your material is, I'm going to use the word astonishing, because it's a brilliant run on I Bet You Miss the IRA Now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because we were a better standard of terrorist.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to phone you up, have a WeChat, tell you where the bomb was and what time it would go off. And now you've got Al-Qaeda. But what's amazing about that? It's 2007. It's only 2 years since 50-whatever people died in a bombing in central London.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure everybody knows that before you get on Live at the Apollo, somebody comes along and sees your act and sees that material somewhere else, mm-hmm. don't they? Mm-hmm. So it obviously had all been seen. Mm. Did you hesitate at any point to do that stuff?
How can you hesitate to walk on stage in London and do material about something horrific whenever you live in another part of the United Kingdom that entire country has been through the same thing, and you're doing that material sometimes on the same day or the day after?
2 years later was nothing, as far as you were concerned.
Well, I mean, look, you know, Lenny Bruce said that, you know, comedy is tragedy plus time. I think that you have to be very, very careful about what are you making the joke about.
This, you, can I just say, the sound effect is actually Otto making my steak tartare.
Yeah,
it's a long process.
It is a long process.
But it's a good one.
It's good. The if you're making a joke about someone's opinions towards something bigger, then that's a valid joke.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get it wrong and sometimes you get it right.
Did you get much of a response to that the next day? Do you remember it going out and then noise?
No, weirdly. Weirdly.
That is weird.
Most of the noise was from British Muslims going, thanks. Thanks, because we're not that.
Yeah.
You know, that idea of being a Muslim and actually walking on a tube.
And getting a seat because you got a backpack.
And getting a seat because you got a backpack. When you're just going out to do your work and what you got in the backpack's your lunch. That was the reaction, weirdly, that I got from that, in the same way that there was only two gates that an aeroplane could land at Heathrow Airport from Northern Ireland.
I didn't know that.
For years, right? And those were the only two places where you had two special branch.
Standing to watch.
Right. Now, if you were a man of a certain age, a young man in his 20s, traveling on his own, you were pulled in.
And were you?
Of course.
I'm just curious as to they get used to you coming through and going, oh, it's all right, it's just your man Keelty, you can let him through.
I tell you what is funny, they got that used to it that when I started to host TV here, I remember going back to Belfast one morning. I've been hosting the big breakfast. It was the late 90s or early 2000s. The National Lottery had started. Des O'Connor was actually the original face of the lottery, and he was going to Belfast. His costume lady was my costume lady. I walk into the airport, I'm at security, she's in front of me, Des O'Connor's there. Oh, Pat, nice to meet you. I love your stuff. I've seen you a few times. How, Des? Everything's very pally.
That's a very good Des O'Connor impersonation, right? If I may say so.
This is Marcy, and everything's going great. Two of us put our bags through. The next thing, the security guy goes, Mr. O'Connor, Mr. Keeley, you might want to just, can you just come, which one of you guys owns this bag? We go through, round to the other side, and it's my bag, clearly. There's a handgun in the middle of the bag.
What?
And I'm going, it's the big breakfast props department. They know I'm flying back to Belfast.
And is they this thought it'd like be a
some type of sick joke? So they put like a fake gun in my bag. And they turn to Des O'Connor and go, do you know, I've only just met Pat, I'm not right. So from being like the showbiz pally, Des is going, I don't know who this Irish fucker is. And just as it gets to that uncomfortable moment, they hit this button underneath the machine and the gun disappears. And they can actually, for training exercises, they can actually put certain objects into the bag. So if you're training on the machine, when you actually go through the airport, you can ask this, who's driving today? So who's driving is the guy who's actually sitting there, right, looking at the bags they go through.
And they're doing it what?
They do that as a thing when you're training, so you can actually run the machine. So it's basically like the equivalent of, you know, being in the aeroplane simulator. So then this even like really more uncomfortable moment where Des now realizes there is no gun and he's gonna have to talk to me after disowning me and sitting beside me in seats. He's in 1A and I'm in 1A.
So you've got the veal T-bone.
I do.
With many things.
Now, I leave you that truffle sauce here. You may want some, if you...
Thank you.
If you want some extra truffle sauce.
Yeah.
I leave your rusty here. You can put that on the
I'd love a wee bit more sparkling, please. Please, thank you very much. Thank you, Otto. That's great.
I hope you enjoyed. Bon appétit.
Yeah, wow. And what are these bad boys here?
Pomme soufflé. Oh, my.
These may take 45 minutes to make.
Is the writing of comedy still...
torturous, yes.
Well, it's a thing in your head. I mean, you're still... You still gig?
Yeah.
Do you feel an imperative to do a certain kind of comedy?
I think if you're going to get up on stage, you have to have something to say. And I think you have to have something that interests yourself. Stand-up's a lonely thing. You know, the idea of a band going on tour... 4 or 5 of them. You can only fall out with yourself when you're doing stand-up.
More than enough comedians have done that.
100%. So, and I also think there's a balance between being really hilarious and being sane. I'm quite sane and sometimes funny. I'm happy with that balance.
Did the idea of doing the documentaries, did it at the time seem like a nice diversion from the grind of writing comedy?
There kind of comes a point where you have to try to tell the truth without the laugh.
That's almost Beckett-esque, you know. As in a comedian who...
As in Rob Beckett.
Yes, Rob Beckett. I was thinking Sam. So I've heard you talk about the fact that, first of all, you chase the laugh, then you have to stop chasing the laugh and know that a bit of silence is okay.
100%.
And then with the documentaries, you let the silence take over.
So there's that thing of, there kind of just comes a point where you have to say, well, this is how it is. The anxiety in that is quite high. When most people think the anxiety of actually getting on stage with a quarter of an inch of microphone cable and saying, this is what I think is funny, what do you think? That's a high anxiety thing for other people.
That's your comfort zone.
100%. Where can I buy me some of that? Don't make me go on the telly and tell the truth.
Because these documentaries, there is a structure which is interact with someone and then you'll be immediately put on camera to say how you're feeling.
Yeah.
And it works very efficiently. I'm curious as to whether people around you at various times while you've been doing this have worried about you. But during the shooting of the last one, where you were going to a dark place, and not just about the state of Northern Ireland, but I think you were dealing with questions around the death of your own father, which you thought you dealt with but hadn't. That looked really hard.
I don't think there's anything worth doing that isn't really hard. Was it really uncomfortable? Yeah. Uncomfortable stuff sometimes is what you think is going to happen. Other times it's just stuff that hits you on the road. I didn't think that the moment I was going to cry in that documentary was people here shouldn't have to do this twice. I wasn't prepared for that to be the breaking point. You can't sit there and ask someone to give you their honest story and not give yourself back.
That's the empathy thing, which is intense.
No, I don't see that as empathy. I just see that as being a fucking fraud if you don't. Everybody struggles every day, you know?
Were there people around you who were concerned about you?
I think there were, weirdly. I think there were a lot of people who were more concerned about me than I was about myself. You know, sometimes it's that thing of you get on with stuff and process it later. I think after the documentary went out, was a bit of a...
When the first one went out, you went for a walk along the beach.
Oh, I couldn't watch it.
So this one? Did you sit and watch it go out?
I did, because I couldn't do anything else.
I'm going to sort of take this full circle.
Hmm.
You met Mel Brooks, didn't you?
Hmm.
How did that happen and what was that? I mean, it sounds like a non sequitur, but it's comedy and it's nerdy, neurotic people. So, neurotic Northern Irishman meets neurotic Jew.
Hmm. I was in LA. I had been talking to Radio 2 and they had said, you know, do you want to do some stuff with Comedy Heroes? And I said, yeah, I'd love to talk to a few people. I said, well, look, do you think you could get Mel Brooks? Went to his house, invited in, and you're sitting there, and out he comes in his sweatpants. When you interview someone like that, he has to know that you know. I mean, obviously a fan, but unless you got the detail, unless you've got his detail, he's not entertained. Meant to be half an hour, ended up there for an hour and a half.
What was the detail? There's always one detail where the person goes, oh, okay, you've done your homework.
The detail was that in the 1950s, he had written on a series that everyone had forgotten. And that was the making of him. Right. And I asked him what it was like to write on that. And the other detail was that when you're a comedy writer and you're directing people in your movies, at what point are you going, you're fucking up my line? It needs to be done like this, or do you actually let them just get on with it? And he started to talk about Gene Wilder and everything else, and it was an incredible afternoon. Went to interview Steve Martin, and
how did that go?
Steve Martin and Martin Short at a backstage at a winery in San Jose, at which point I was petrified with Steve Martin because I thought he was going to be tricky and I thought Martin was going to be ha-ha. It was kind of the other way around. Martin was the sort of slightly trickier one and Steve was much, you know, so you just never know. You never know what you're going to get.
Well, I could say exactly the same, but I'm going to be honest with you, Paddy Keelty, and say you were everything I hoped and more. I'm gonna bring the recording bit to an end now because otherwise poor producers are stuck with 14 hours of tape.
Oopsie.
But I'm going to say, as Paddy Keelty, thank you very much for letting me take you out to lunch. There's still a tart-tat-tat in your future. Yeah, you did order that.
No, I just actually think that could be my headstone.
Do you think? There's a tart-tat-tat in my future.
There's a tart-tat-tat in my future. Could be it.
Could be it.
That's a good point to finish.
I think so.
Yeah.
Although we've got quite a lot of food in front of us. Thank you.
Can't thank you enough, Jay.
And I can assure you, we were there for long after the tape had stopped rolling. What a brilliant person Paddy is. A huge thank you to Otto for his outstanding hospitality. Do check out his restaurant, Otto's, on London's Gray's Inn Road. True classical French cooking with bells on. There really is nowhere else like it in the UK. If you love the show, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. And as ever, we would be delighted if you could leave us a review, maybe a star rating. 5? Would 5 kill you? I'm sure not. It really helps others to find us. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording and mix engineer was Josh Gibbs. Assistant producers are Anya Das and Bethany Hocken. The producer is Selena Ream and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Next time, it's Grammy award-winning singer-songwriter Gregory Porter.
Didn't you once do a wedding and the only songs you knew were sad songs?
Right. And I was like, you know... So I get on the microphone. What'll I do when you are far away and I am blue? What'll I do? Wait a minute.
Are they all breakup songs?
Wait a minute. My book doesn't work.